Hello, and thank you for joining us on this episode of The Dev Team. I'm Mark Onsman.
I'm Daryl Kilzer.
And I'm Jake Overall.
We're a group of developers and bootcamp instructors here to help you in joining the world as a software developer. Whether you're a self-taught developer, bootcamp grad, or a CS student, we're here to help you fill in some of the knowledge you need to grow in your role as a junior developer.
On this week's episode, Daryl starts us off with compiled code. Mark talks about Microsoft pulling its data center out of the ocean and the United Airlines leak. Finally, I wrap up with the things that slow us down.
Today I wanted to talk about compiled code and compilers and kind of what they do for us. So if you write a lot of C-sharp or any other C-based languages, you're sure to have heard of this term. As high-level software developers, this is a word that I think is not commonly understood as well as it could be. Developers used to write code that was what we would call low-level, and it was just a series of numbers and letters and contained specific instruction sets that the machine could actually use. Today, we write what's called high-level code, and we use a compiler that actually will interpret that code into what's called an intermediate language or something of that nature. And then we'll use another compiler, a just-in-time compiler, that will actually interpret it into something the machine can use. This is how it works for C#. I won't pretend that I know exactly how JavaScript does it. I think, Jake, you might have a little more experience with that.
Yeah, I think it's the concept of the JIT, right? The just-in-time compiler. It's fascinating, right? And I think that's where you start to get into a whole new level of, like, we are way, way beyond skilled of compared to like what I do, right? And I think it's one of those things that for a long time, I almost felt like there was a deficiency or something of that nature in my knowledge because, I didn't understand the JIT compiler. I didn't understand compilers in general. What's the difference between transpilation and compilation? And, I think that as I've progressed further and further into the career field, it's one of those things where, I may not actually be as good of a developer in some of those like C-based languages, right? Like C#, love it. I won't pretend to have a deep understanding though of the compiler or the JIT process. And that's one of those things that I don't know if it's really that big of a deal. I'm okay with writing my higher level languages, I guess is what I'm getting at there.
Yeah, I'd add to that, like, same boat, right? And I think that that's okay. I've run into people before and, they're like, oh, what language do you write in? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I do this or that and the other thing. They're like, oh, so you're not writing real code.
You're not a real developer.
You're not a real
developer.
You
only do web stuff.
And I think that that is so overblown and so, like, blown out of proportion and ridiculous, right? Quite frankly, there is a place in the world for both those people. And I think that why that's, this branches into a bigger concept entirely, but that's where you see, people, oh, well, you're not a real developer unless you have a CS degree, right? Well, I didn't need to learn robotics to write web applications. And so I think that, certainly it's good to know these are things that don't use that word wrong because then I might call you on it or don't put on your resume. Yeah, I understand compilers unless you actually do. And so I think it's a good thing to be knowledgeable of to that extent. And then you make that decision. Is this something I want to get further into? And if so, I hope you like math and data science.
Yeah, and I think that's a big thing. Like, I'm actually pretty good friends with one of the maintainers of a newer language. I don't know if you guys have even heard of it or not, but it's called Red. And they have essentially Red high level and they have Red low level. And I can't remember, they have different names for those two things. But, he's one of those like major geek guys. And, I say that with all the love in the world.
Absolutely.
But, he's very smart. And it's one of those things where he's solving problems that are very different than the types of problems that I set out to solve on a daily basis as well, right? And I think a lot of, picking the right language, and maybe we've talked about this in the past or not on this particular podcast, but it's choosing the right tool for the right job. Daryl, very often in game development, like you're going to want to choose one of these lower languages just for performances alone, right?
Oh, absolutely. I would say that was a common thing, even going in there and providing these instruction sets. What's interesting there is it's also very tied into hardware. So for game development, that's a huge consideration. You'll very often write at the lower level, for sure.
Yeah, and even a language like C#, which is, you know, technically a higher level language, even though it does have a compiler and things of that nature, you know, the Unity game engine really like doubled down with C#, and I know I think Godot is as well uses a C# style language, but there are processes that, especially in game development, when you're dealing with, you know, intense graphics or, you know, thousands of enemies or something of that nature, that the JIT compiler just, quite frankly, it doesn't cut it, right? And so you want to make sure that the code gets compiled down and that the JIT, you know, the just-in-time compiler doesn't have to actually go through that process. And that's a lot of what ECS is all about, or the Unity's new DOT system is pulling those things out of the JIT runtime and throwing them down into an even lower level so that, you know, it's not slowing down the game.
Yeah, anything you can pull out of runtime is always super helpful there, for sure. And you spoke a little bit on transpiling earlier. I thought that was interesting and quite considered that for today's topic as well. But that's a good use case as well, and the differences there. When we write JavaScript with a framework like Vue or something like that, right? Writing it in a particular format, and we're actually using a process there to transpile it into standard JavaScript format.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the whole very premise behind TypeScript, you know, at least as we see TypeScript today. I know with some of the new advancements in TypeScript, you know, kind of the things that are kind of more fringe that we're pushing towards is, you know, an understanding of TypeScript built into the browser, so we don't have to necessarily transpile ahead of time, you know, and I think Deno is actually doing this right now, if you've followed it all with Deno or not, but it's an actual understanding of the TypeScript language so that it doesn't have to go through a transpiler first, and so that we're getting actual like runtime safety with TypeScript. You know, again, fascinating, right? Not necessarily my realm. I'm not going to pretend that, you know, I have any deep understanding of how Deno's, you know, underlying system works, but being able to write in these higher level languages is what is progressing our career field so much and so quickly. And it kind of opens up the barriers. And I think that's one of those things, Mark, you were talking about, you know, you're not a real developer. There's plenty of gatekeeping enough in this world. Let's not add any more, especially in the world of geeks and nerds, right?
Like, right. And I think for me, it's the biggest piece that I encourage is, again, you know, understand what these things are so that you don't misspeak or you start to kind of say, oh, well, you mean like compilers like Gulp and Grunt? Well, not quite, right? There's another whole different realm of things. Like those are task runners or Webpack, you know, as a module bundler and stuff like that. So be aware of like what is one thing versus another and try and research into those distinctions. And, you know, maybe you might find a new interest as you're driving down that pathway of, hey, I'm looking at compilers. Now I'm looking at bundlers. And what's the difference? And how does this one do this? And how does this one do that? And you might find, you know, an interest or a passion there. And if nothing else, at least you've learned something.
Yeah. And I think awareness is a big thing, but don't confuse awareness with the need for deep knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, I am going to move us on here and dive into kind of some news from today, or this week at least. So I don't know, did you guys see the creature pulled out of the deep this week?
I did.
The creature from the deep, aka the Microsoft servers that were actually put in the ocean as an experiment to kind of see, is the ocean a reasonable place for a data center?
Yeah, I actually saw the pictures of them, you know, pulling up the big data center and, you know, hosing down the Microsoft logo. I read a little bit on that article and I find it really interesting. They were talking about failure rate of that data center where they've been pumping nitrogen into it as opposed to oxygen. And
there's nobody in it.
There's no one in it. And I think like their failure rate was something like 8%.
It was only eight, right? Servers, not even 8%. I believe if I remember reading it, it was eight, and I have to pull up the news article again.
No, I think it was something like there's 900 servers.
Right, right.
sitting in that tube, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you saw the pictures, but talk about claustrophobia for me.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But yeah, the failure rate was like very, very minimal compared to a standard data center.
To me, the biggest case for that, and I think that you'd have to really look at, again, the processes, and I'd have to dig in deeper to like, what was their methodology and the approach to it? Because is it a true experiment? Like, did you have the person who's normally setting up these data centers, or did you take extra care and extra attention and all this extra efforts?
That's a fair observation and not one that I even really considered yet.
Right. What extra efforts went into putting those together, right? That may not in a normal data center, because in a normal data center, they're so much easier to access if you need to fix it versus this, it's like, well, it's under the ocean. But there's two sides to that coin, right? The other piece is, of course, there's not daily maintenance. I'm not working on the server right above it and accidentally bump or mess up the one beneath it. Now I kind of cascade into that problem. So, you know, less human contact from a, you know, setup standpoint to a general maintenance and care standpoint. But overall, I think that they did find that with the experiment that it does seem very viable.
Yeah, I think the other thing to consider there, though, is, you know, cost to risk ratio and things of that nature, right? Like, and that's Microsoft, and who knows what their metrics are for measuring these types of things, right? But one thing that I thought was pretty interesting about that whole experiment as well is, you know, that very concept of, you know, let's take this data center and let's submerge it in the ocean. Only a company as big as Microsoft is going to have the funds to even, you know, experiment with something of this nature. But I know that environmentalists were like really concerned about, you know, what about the vibrations? What, you know, what potential harm are we introducing into the ecosystem of, you know, submersing a data center in the ocean? And I don't know if they had any reports or anything on that or not.
So on a different note, just to circle back, it was 1/8 the rate of a normal center. So it's not actually 8% failure rate, or it's just 1/8 of normal. So whatever.
That's a big improvement.
This is a huge improvement still.
Yeah, but is that improvement enough to offset the cost, right?
That's what you got to figure out. Yeah, that'd be interesting. And on that note, too, with the environmentalist, right? How much does it heat the area? Does that cause any like tide changes or anything like that? Or do they have it in a specific spot? Do they create a bay for it? Like,
is the noise keeping the fish awake? You know, I don't mean to just bring levity to that, because right. I think it is a real concern, especially if a lot of companies started to say, hey, yeah, we're going to submerge our data centers. Like, what are the long-term detrimental effects there? Like, that is something that should be taken into consideration as well.
I mean, we do have more ocean than land, so.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing to consider, right, is when you're weighing that, does it affect the ocean? And I think it would be unfair to say, no, it doesn't affect it in any way, shape, or form, right? That's obviously not the case. But is it less of an environmental impact than keeping it on land, right? And so I think that for a lot of things that you have to weigh that cost benefit, right, is it more beneficial? Because I don't think you're ever going to find, you know, obviously in this situation we're in right now, you're never going to find a perfect. This is completely no issue whatsoever. It's 100% safe, 100% no impact. But I think at the very least, if you could find a way to lessen the impact, that's at least, that's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. And I know that Microsoft has actually put out a public goal to become carbon neutral by, I think it's like 2022. And then they are hoping by 2030 that they actually become carbon negative. And for a company such as large as Microsoft, like that is a huge, huge goal. And I hope they actually do achieve it.
So on that note, that was one thing I did come across while I was researching news. Google is officially now carbon zero as of like yesterday.
So
they announced carbon neutral, right? They're not negative yet, but Google has announced that they are running carbon neutral. I didn't have enough of a story beyond that. That's just the announcement. But since you brought it up. The other story I wanted to kind of chat about just real briefly is I wanted to touch on United Airlines Ticket League. Basically, what happened is, as a United customer, if I wanted a refund from the airline, I could go to their website and submit that refund request or whatever, and I could check its status by providing my ticket number and my passenger name. However, it was found out that it actually didn't validate that those two things belong together. It just validated you were a passenger and this was a valid ticket ID, and then sent you the refund information. So, because those tickets are sequential, all I had to do was increment or decrement my ticket number, and I could find other customers' refund information.
So I could it had to be a valid passenger name.
Correct.
Though.
Yep.
But it didn't have to match with the ticket.
Yeah, you could use your own name.
Oh, man.
And apply a sequential number.
At the bare minimum, at least it's easy to identify, like, who's making those requests. I hope they were logging the passenger name, but that is a very gross oversight.
ultimately, the information that was leaked, it's significant enough. It wasn't actually their credit card information, but it was enough to, again, pull off that identity theft of their name, a time and date that they would have been traveling, their payment, last for their payment, and the payment type. So given that, that's obviously been enough in the past to definitely impersonate people.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, and I think that's where, you know, there's the concept behind application security that often just gets completely overlooked because we worry so much about like infrastructure security. There's so much security focus brought into, you know, networking and systems and hardware that I think the most common attack vector continues to be software. And I think, and this is a whole nother topic for probably a whole nother day, but I think a large part of that problem is the lack of education for application security for the average software developer.
Yeah, things just don't get thought about. They end up in there, and it seems like it wouldn't be much of an issue, and then till it is, of course.
Right. Yeah. 100% that. I think that so many people think, oh, hacker, right? They're hacking our network, or they're hacking this, or hacking that. No, more often than not, it's somebody made a poor decision at some point in the architecture or in the design of validation, and then that's where that loophole is.
Form validation and SQL injection, right? I think some big university actually, I can't remember who it was, but they just sent out, it was like an award or something. I saw like it on Reddit or whatever, but someone received a nice little bounty for identifying a SQL injection on some sort of university website. I can't remember exactly what it was, but you know, it again, it goes back to show that our most common attack vectors continue to be stupid things like SQL injection. Like, I mean, what year is this? We should be well beyond those things. And the fact that we're not is quite frankly terrifying.
Yeah, it's easier to hack the software, you know, use the software as it was built rather than to actually hack these things.
Right. It's not nefarious. It's not backdoors. It's either laziness or lack of education.
Yeah. And kind of to round that out, ultimately, I think that that's where, you know, we've heard this in other posts and things like that before, but, you know, always code like you're being attacked. Always think, when I'm writing this, how could this be misused? How, you got to start working as a developer to think around those corners in what am I not thinking about, or what are attack vectors? And don't start thinking immediately like, well, if they hack into our network, think of how could this form be broken?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, and we were talking about this just the other, I think last week, just on the side, not on this podcast, but it was, you know, we could build software a whole lot faster and we could deliver a whole lot faster if we just never really cared or bothered to check, you know, are you the right person for accessing this piece of information? And, you know, way too often, too many, and these are big name companies are making these decisions with real world data. When I say it's companies, no, it's not. It's us. It's us as software application developers who are not taking the due diligence and the time necessary before shipping and delivering products.
You may have hit on something there, though. Cost, right? Maybe they're pushing deadlines too fast and someone has a cut corner somewhere and that might be it.
And I didn't mean to make this the deep dive, so I will turn it back over to you, Jake, to specifically do that. And maybe we circle back up on this topic.
So let's go ahead and jump right into the deep dive then. My topic for today is, it's kind of one of those things that as a team, what is it that's making you less performant? What is it that is making us slow? And I think that's it's a very common question. It's often posed in, you know, your Scrum cycles and things of that nature. And it's just being able to identify what is it that is making us slow or less performant.
So first, as the CSM of the team, I'm going to tell you that is a retrospective.
That's the word I was looking for. Thank you.
For me, and of course, in that same role, of course, I'm going to jump immediately to organization. I think that for me, oftentimes, there are things that I see when we have our students group up and things like that, and they do their capstone projects, or, you know, when we've worked it ourselves, the biggest thing that fails is either lack of planning and / lack of organization. Taking that time early on, which always, I think, as developers, we just want to get into the code. We just want to start writing, and I don't want to think about the big picture right now. I just want to get this piece working. And especially as you become more experienced as a developer, oftentimes you do fall into that trap of, I know I shouldn't be looking at the big picture because I can never conceptualize all the stuff that needs to be done. Let me just focus on my one thing. But I think that that is where we make that mistake, is in those early planning phases, there isn't enough organization. We don't make enough decisions. We don't make enough plans that when we get to that point, then it's like, oh, wait, now what? And if I change my decision then, after I've built half the application, now I might have to go back and rebuild 10, 20, 30% of that, what I've already written.
Yeah, absolutely. Another one that I can say that I've personally experienced in game development is essentially at the manager level or a liaison level, right? So we had a ton of artists, like 70 artists, I think, and like 40 developers. And one person that was kind of the liaison between those two. And so there would be a lot of projects that would just be sitting there like, hey, somebody's got to go through and get all these models ported over, or make sure all this code is ready to go for this particular project, or just interpret and kind of make sure all of those things are working together. And that's a huge task. And oftentimes, being the person that had that job, I would look at some of the projects that I knew weren't going to make us much money, and those would kind of sit there for a couple weeks. And so that's a huge roadblock, is if you have one single person or maybe a smaller team that just doesn't have enough manpower to actually remove those roadblocks.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I wanted to bring the focus to is 99% of the time, I think what slows us down as dev teams or product delivery teams or, you know, whatever you want to call what it is we do, right? Software delivery. It's not the tech stack. It's not the coding languages. It's not the lack of skill in the things that we as professionals are skilled in, right? It's not the coding languages. It's not the Adobe products or, you know, whatever the designers are using. It usually comes down to the bureaucrat of business and trying to make decisions and organization, right? And so that's, I don't want to necessarily, you know, just trash on managers or things of that nature, but I think that oftentimes there is a divide in the understanding of what is a true bottleneck versus, you know, what is a problem that just doesn't have a solution yet, right? And I think that those are two very different things. And more often than not, I feel like we're waiting on decisions to be made as opposed to not knowing how to actually do something.
Yeah, absolutely. Choose your problem and I'll give you a solution.
Yeah, I think to kind of build on Daryl a little bit, and that kind of talks to yours a little bit too, is obviously identifying specifically communication is kind of the summary keyword for that, right? So you have organization, you have communication. And for me, communication is also, and again, this is because I've been in the CSM type role, communication should be frequent and planned, and it should be very clear that from here to here, this is what your goals are. And if you finish those, here's what some stretch goals are in that meantime, because this is what's coming up down the pipeline. Because it's been communicated at some point, this is what we're doing, and this is the steps that need to be done. I don't have to have that constant like, well, what do you want to do now? 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 Or, hey, look at this, and while I'm waiting for you to approve it, I'm going to sit here and twiddle my thumbs.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a lot of software out there to kind of help with this organization piece, but that also requires a lot of work just to, you know, manage and maintain, the Jira environment or something of that nature, right? Like the GitHub pull requests and, you know, ticketing and all that other stuff. Like, there is a lot of man hours that just need to go into organization, and it's not the most glamorous thing. And that's why I think so often it becomes the bottleneck, is because no one really wants to do it, right? So what are some strategies that we could potentially talk about to help eliminate that as the problem? Because I think that is that key point of, you know, here's, we've identified the bottleneck. What are solutions?
This is where I sit awkwardly and stare at you guys, because I usually have to fall into this role of organization. And I think that's really what it boils down to, is essentially you need someone on your team to step up and say, okay, I may not be in charge, but I can be that facilitator to make sure everyone understands what the plan is, everyone has their tasks, and they know what to do when those tasks are done. And as well as identifying those bottlenecks. So to me, it's almost like, and again, I know that this is where most people in general, it becomes like, oh man, not another meeting. But it's that you have to have that conversation at some point. You have to, the expression, swallow the frog. Right. No one likes that meeting. No one likes the, let's sit down and talk through our everything we need to do. Right. Cause it can get very boring and very dull, but it has to happen. So to me, it's what are solutions to make that a better meeting, and, you know, mix it up, have those planning meetings on walks, do it remotely, have food, stuff like that. Because
food's always good, right?
Food's always good. Right. And I think that that's, to me, making that meeting more accessible and more enjoyable, because to me, the solution is you have to plan and you have to make decisions on who's responsible for what.
Yeah. And I think one of the things to specifically call out here, and this is a topic that is I think a lot of companies get wrong, right? And we have a friend who now works for Microsoft, and he was talking to us about kind of the way that Microsoft addresses these types of problems. And I think a very common problem that dev teams or product teams, again, run into is I'm a really good developer, and so I get promoted and I become a manager, but I suck at managing people. I am not good at, you know, that delivering tasks and telling you that, oh, hey, you're behind on this target and things of that nature. Like, I'm not a super great people person, but I've been promoted into that role because, you know, maybe I'm the developer who's been here the longest, or I'm the most skilled developer, and now I just got promoted into a position that, quite frankly, I'm no good at.
You're 100% referring to the Peter principle from Office Space, essentially. It's this concept that, yeah, you are promoted into ignorance, right? If you're good at your job, get a promotion. If you're good at that job, you get a promotion. And you keep getting that promotion until you're no longer good at your job, and then you just stay in that job.
And then you're stuck there forever. And that's how I think people get stuck with awful, awful managers, right?
Yeah. And having been in quite a few different industries, I can say it's not a problem that's like unique to our industry, but I would say it's way more exaggerated here. And there's a couple of things that I think kind of tie into that. One, personality types, right? I know myself personally, I have something that I want to do. This was why I left game development, right? I wanted to build video games, and I always ended up being a manager and didn't really enjoy it. I wouldn't have minded doing that on a couple small projects. And I think that's where we kind of fail in this industry, is the cross-training. Cross-training was always a big thing in all of the other industries, mostly because they were a little lower skilled, and so it was pretty easy for anyone to kind of fill those roles. In our realm, that's not necessarily the case. It actually requires a lot of work to keep up on whatever you're developing in. I know there's a couple things that are out there trying to address that through Scrum specifically. There's Scrum for developers. And I think that's kind of one of those things that's trying to do that. It's saying, hey, maybe all developers can be a little more aware of how this process works. Maybe someone can step up and take over that role or assist in that role.
And you mentioned Microsoft had their own kind of approach.
Yeah. So talking with our buddy who works for Microsoft, he was talking about how Microsoft has essentially the exact same, you know, scale, pay level type of idea, but one is focused on you're going deeper and deeper into being a tech expert, and the other one is a management path, right? And managing people is very different than managing a project. Managing people or teams of people is very different than trying to determine which piece of software we should use, you know, what is the best technology stack for this type of thing. And it's oftentimes when that person has to split their attention between trying to make tech decisions and trying to manage the dev team that I think you fall into these problems, right? And so Microsoft's system, or their solution for it, was we have managers that get equal amounts of pay. They have equal amounts of like seniority within the company and, you know, benefits and all that other stuff that comes with a bigger company, but they're very distinct tracks, and their responsibility set is very specific to a team manager versus a, you know, tech manager. And so I found it just kind of really interesting with kind of the way that, you know, they figure that out. And I think a lot of other companies, especially as we have so many companies now venturing into the tech realm, that, you know, be aware that this is a big problem that, you know, huge tech giants like Microsoft faced, and they came up with a solution for it.
And I think this is kind of important to even call out that Daryl mentioned this too, and he's right, that Scrum kind of tries to address this at the end of the sprint. There's two different meetings. You have your sprint review and your retrospective, and it breaks down to kind of separate and distinguish, like, here are the tech pieces that we need to address. And aside from that, here are the kind of emotional or the relationship pieces that we need to address.
Yeah. If you've ever sat in like a larger company and kind of set through one of those larger meetings, you've got HR in there, you've got engineers in there, and you've got all these different people in there. Those meetings aren't very productive. And so I think you're absolutely right with that.
Yeah. And so, and I think, and you, you I disagree that the productivity, I think the productivity, you just, you distinguish one meeting to the next.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. And that's more what you mean. When you try and force it all into one place, it becomes incredibly unproductive.
Yeah. HR is just sitting there falling asleep while the engineers are going through their stuff and vice versa.
Yeah. Brittany, our HR team, as it were, or at least a part of it, she talks about her dead meter, right? As soon as we start talking tech, her dead meter falls. And I think the other people, it's the other way. But I think that that's kind of the big thing, is distinguishing that we need to have both these types of people on our team, so that when we have these meetings, they can be productive. Because we all know the meetings have to exist. And it's, again, love them or hate them, you have to have some sort of process where you're saying, let's establish what the plan is and who's going to do what. And you definitely need people on both sides of the table.
Yeah. And I think, you know, a big part of that is helping individuals identify an appropriate metric for, you know, what is a successful meeting? Because you talked about, you know, unsuccessful meetings. Maybe an unsuccessful meeting that Daryl is sitting through, who he's falling asleep because HR is talking, you know, he doesn't understand the metric behind why this is so important. And I don't necessarily say that you have to understand that metric, but, you know, maybe you're not the right person for that particular meeting. But I think it's just, you know, different meetings, you know, different skill sets, things that need to be accomplished, and progress forward is progress forward, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, anything else?
That'll wrap it up for me.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and close it out with that then. And I appreciate everyone again joining us here on the dev team. And if you have enjoyed this episode or any of our previous episodes, please make sure to like and subscribe, whether it's Spotify, Google, or whatever your favorite podcast network is. And last but not least, enjoy your rest of your week and happy coding.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Dev Team. If you're interested in learning more about our team or possibly starting a career in software development, reach out to us at BoiseCodeWorks.com. Follow us on Facebook and like and subscribe to this podcast to continue to receive the latest updates. Until then, from The Dev Team, remember, if you want clean code, wash your hands.